by professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. There are about 25 lodges situated in various parts of the world. These lodges operate individually, but are nevertheless united by aim, purpose, and teaching, and also the idea of forming a nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity. This Philadelphia Lodge participates in this worldwide spiritual movement by way of conducting 2 weekly meetings on Sunday mornings from 11 until 12 noon, and on Wednesday evenings from 7:45 until 9 o'clock. Now, during the month of November, there will be a general theme on which November presentations will be presented. And the theme for November is General Theosophical Principles. Now, the talk for today is entitled, One Life, One Self, One Source. And on next Sunday morning, there will be a panel entitled, Karma, Nemesis, or Merciful. Now, these Sunday morning meetings are followed by a period for questions and discussions. On Wednesday evenings, there is a study class in Mr. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy. Now, the class has concluded Chapter 2, and this coming Wednesday, it will begin the third chapter. And the subject of that study will be Evolution of the Earth Follows Universal Principles. Now, on Wednesday evenings from 5:30 until 7:30, the reference library is open for research and study. It carries a straight line of theosophical literature consisting of books, pamphlets, and magazines, all comprising the original writings of the founders of the theosophical movement. Also, you will find in the library on Wednesdays a reference in reference to the evening's class. Just outside of the library, you will find this same theosophical literature on sale. It may be purchased either during the library hours or before or after our regular meetings. All activities of this lodge are free. The lodge continues to be sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money, and all are most welcome to participate. The reading for today has been taken from notes on the Bhagavad Gita. The wise grieve not for the dead or the living, But never at any period did I, or thou, or these kings of men not exist, nor shall any of us at any time henceforward cease to exist. As the soul and the body undergoes the changes of childhood, prime, and age, so it obtains a new body hereafter. A sensible man is not troubled about that, but the contact of the elements, O son of Kunti, which bring cold and heat, pleasure and pain, which come and go and are temporary, these do thou endure, O Bharata. For that man whom, being the same in pain and pleasure, and ever constant, these elements do not afflict, is fitted for immortality. There is no existence for what does not exist, nor is there any non-existence for what exists. Know this, that by which all this universe is created is indestructible. No one can cause the destruction of this inexhaustible thing. He who believes that this spirit can kill, and he who thinks it can be killed, both of these are wrong in judgment. It is not born nor dies at any time. It has no origin, nor will it ever have an end. Unborn, changeless, eternal, both as to future and past time. It is not slain when the body is killed. How can that man, O son of Pritha, who knows that it is indestructible, constant, unborn, and inexhaustible, really cause the death of anybody or anybody himself? As a man abandoneth worn out clothes and takes other new ones, so does the soul quit worn out bodies and enter other new ones. Weapons cannot cleave it, fire cannot burn it, nor can water wet it, nor wind dry it. It is constant, capable of going everywhere, firm, immovable, and eternal. It is said to be invisible, incomprehensible, immutable. Therefore, knowing it to be such, thou art not right to grieve for it. Many will think that it is well to have attachment to good consequences, since that has been the received opinion. But this is unwise, because the only reason for it is found in the idea that thereby one is enamored with evil results, desire to see them come to pass. This idea produces separateness and is opposed to that identity with the realization of which there can be no true knowledge. We should therefore be imitators of the deity, who, while acting as he does in the manifestation of the universes, is at the same time free from all consequences. To the extent that we are so, we become the deity himself. For as we follow the dictates of the Lord who dwells in us, we resign every act upon the altar, leaving the consequences to him. The subject of the talk for this morning is one life, one self, and one source.
So as was said in the opening announcements, this month's title, umbrella topic, is General Theosophical Principles. And today's being One Life, One Self, and One Source. Now, if one would look at how the topics are aligned for this month, we can see then that they're kind of built on top of each other. And the first one for this Sunday, One Life, One Self, and One Source, is a very important, actually three ideas, but actually one idea, too. And it's important because this is like a foundation for what the rest of the month's topics are going to be on. So they're crucial to the understanding of the philosophy. Yet it is really a huge, huge topic that we're going to be talking about today. And it was kind of hard to arrange things. How are we going to set it up? And so, because some people could think that this is an easy topic to understand and other people may be somewhat confused. But and then we're looking at, are they the same? Are they different? So there's a lot of questions that may come up during the talk, and we hope that we'll be able to answer them and discuss them afterwards. So, one thing we can start out by thinking about is, does our identity change over the course of our lives? When we move to, when we're born, when we move on to being a toddler, all the way up to being a senior citizen, does anything else change in us besides what our physical form looks like? And is there anything that stays constant? Where does this constant idea, if it does exist, where does it come from? And are other people experiencing the same thing? And man can be known as the microcosm of the macrocosm because we have, in our forms, we have minerals, we have plant, all these different kingdoms are in our body, so we can be looked at as a microcosm of the macrocosm. But anything that is said during this talk, we ask that people, that the philosophy always says, to check, test, and verify everything. So let's see if we can connect and verify some of these ideas. So in order to really look at one life, one self, and one source, we have to definitely broaden our view of what life really is. And if we think of how many people do, that all we have is one life, and after we die, that's it, to us, we think that is a really scary thought, to just not be anymore. And what happens to the matter that's in my body? I mean, does everybody have the same thing? And what about God? Is there a God? So we'll have to look at that as well. And when we're looking at these three items, it's really hard to discuss one and not bring in the other because a lot of what we're going to be talking about is intertwined. So we would like to start out with a quote from The Secret Doctrine, which is, it builds on the readings from the notes of the Bhagavad Gita. And the question is, how can we ever come to regard the inner man as immortal and at the same time as a spiritual entity and a mortal man? So some of these ideas kind of seem a little confusing and contradict each other. So we know that the source in the philosophy has different names. We call it the absolute, omnipresent, omnipotent. The philosophy also describes it as the source of all and is latent in every atom in the universe and is the universe itself. And it states that it is neither spirit nor matter, yet is both. So there's dual things going on here. And it has no attributes, but it has the attitude of beingness. And we use the symbolism of absolute abstract motion and absolute abstract space. But in regards to the source, when we're talking about the absolute, we're talking about deity, it is really hard with our language to definitely come up with a word that sufficiently describes it. So the philosophy would say to take that concept of space being all over, space, everything in space, and space in everything. And it's an interesting concept to try and meditate on what space actually is. So if we try to do that, then we can also meditate about what is this absolute. And we also can look at the analogy of in-breathing, which is what we call pralaya, or that universal rest, or manifestation when the out-breathing, when life comes forth. And this is, so we'll be discussing the ideas of self and life as well, because they are the vehicles of this source. And it is the connections of matter to what we call the universal oversoul. Excuse me. So we discussed initially about the changes that go through our bodies and the surroundings and how that I does not ever change. And that is the unchanging, and it is the only real aspect of us. And it is this that is in us that is the observer, that the perceiver, that is never affected by anger, anything like that, but it always is. And it is how much we allow this essence to come through that will determine the path that we are going to take. Are we looking at being more altruistic? Are we looking at being more materialistic? So we're looking at how much of that universal oversoul, the Atma, that we're going to let through will determine how we are going to proceed in any lifetime. And this immortal something is not only in us, but in all particles and beings. But it is only at a different level of consciousness. And this perception of what we're looking at as being that universal oversoul gives us that perception of self. And we found an interesting short little quote on that. Like the two birds of golden plumage, inseparable companions, the individual self and the immortal self are perched on the branches of the self same tree. The former tastes of the sweet and bitter fruits of the tree, the latter, tasting of neither, calmly observes. So then we are looking at the idea that the finite cannot express the infinite. But what does this mean? That deific essence, the all, does not manifest. It cannot. What happens cyclically after pralaya, manifestation occurs from it. And this is the universal oversoul. It is an aspect of the unknown root. It is a spark of it. So we're looking that the universal oversoul is a spark of that deific essence, and that we are a spark of that universal oversoul. And it is the obligatory pilgrimage of every soul, a spark of the former through the cycle of incarnation or necessity in accordance with cyclic karmic law during the whole term. And that is from the Secret Doctrine. And this universal oversoul is the collective architect, the plan that furnishes it for the universe, the work being carried out by those hierarchies, the sentient beings, messengers, or agents of karmic and cosmic law. And the universal oversoul or spirit, and it travels through various forms of matter. And we're looking at these various forms as being in the mineral kingdom, and then the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, to the highest expression being that of the human kingdom. The growth process, again, is dependent upon that particular kingdom's ability to partake of that universal spark. And in the human, since we do have free will, we and self-consciousness, whereas the lower kingdoms aren't self-conscious, they function mainly from reactive type of actions. But then humans can think, and we can reason from the process to the end. So what causes, we kind of touched on it, what causes the differences in the way the kingdoms are able to tap into that spark? All forms have Atma, which is spirit, Buddhi or intuition, and Manas, which has two aspects in man. But it is only in man that this mind is lit up so that we can make these choices on self-induced and self-devised means. But in the lower kingdoms, this mind, this Manas, is only in germ form. And we can see in the human, we can look at the idea that there are three separate selves, but there's actually only one with three aspects. There is one that is very personal, temporary, that changes with every incarnation and functions predominantly in the lower mind, looking at materialism. And then there is a second one that is progressing and is trying to reach more to that Buddhi principle, that intuitive idea. And then there is that higher self that is the observer, that is the inseparable ray of that universal self. And it is this that proceeds from lifetime to lifetime and is called the individuality, not the personality. And when we can, when considered with mind, we see that the personality is present and it is needed to connect that higher aspect to the lower so that we can function on this level of materialism, because this is where we are going to learn our lessons. So when we consider then, we have looked at the source and we've looked at one of its vehicles being, being that of the self. So the second vehicle then we're looking at is life. And it's like, well, life is life, is what most people would think. But the theosophical idea of life is completely different. When we look at all the preceding ideas that we've discussed, so is there more than one life then? And we can see the different forms that life takes. But so one would think that there is more than one life. But when we're looking at life, if we think life is more than one aspect, then we are only looking at the external. We are looking at that God idea, that God is outside of us, whereas if we look inward, then we will see about that life is internal. And there's an expression, look inward, thou art Buddha. And that is it. This one life is all connected. And we've seen that spirit or Atma is that spark of the universal oversoul. It connects us all. And it is that direct ray from the unknowable. And it is this one common thread between and among all of life that is undivided and is indivisible. And it is this that connects us all. It is this life that proceeds from incarnation to incarnation. And oh, we are so sorry. Thank you. It is this one common thread between and among all of life. And as we said, it is undivided and indivisible. So he who brooding, and this is a quote as well, he who brooding upon sense objects comes to yearn for them, is born here and there again and again, driven by his desire. But he who has realized the self and thus satisfied all hunger attains to liberation even in this life. So if we're looking at how does this, how can I use these ideas practically? We can see then that when we're looking at the idea of universal brotherhood, we can see then that we are all connected by this one source. And connected by this one source, it is our altruistic duty to connect with everyone as a brother soul, because that's what we are. We are brothers and sisters in that one essence. So there was a lot of information that we couldn't possibly have included. So we hope some of these ideas will be covered in your questions and discussions. Yes?
Well, as was pointed out, we really can't describe or limit this all. It has no conditions. So we're really looking at its appearance or face when it expresses itself. And so what we call life or cause or source or self, it's all different ways in which in our minds we can look at the same reality.
Yes, and it is. And when we're looking at reality, the philosophy really does question, like, is what we're seeing here the reality or is it illusion? Because what is illusion is only temporary. It is that I that is us that permeates not only this one life, but all of life. And this I will be the same from incarnation to incarnation. It does not manifest. It always is. So there's this piece of that universal spark that will come through. And we also say that the... we just lost it. Okay, another question. Yes.
I was always wondering that that universal energy that always does exist everywhere in all planes of existence. I always wanted to tap into it, at least lately. But there's no instruction book or set of how to do that. And it kind of bothers me that, that we exist, yet most people are completely devoid of knowledge of that, let alone even those who do know of its existence generally do not are not able to tap into it. You know, I mean, the people who can heal themselves and heal others usually take the energy from that source and apply it to heal themselves and others, and that is where that energy comes from. But not knowing how to do that, we're like, you know, rats in a maze.
Well, we just remembered what we wanted to add, and it kind of goes along with this, is the reason for all for this reincarnation and reincarnation is for the purpose of the development of soul. And in regards to the question that was just asked, it the soul itself, that energy, doesn't really need to be developed in reality. What it is that we're trying to do is to, when it was mentioned about tapping into, that tapping into is making the brain more porous to the dictates of that higher nature. So how do we do that then? And it's not something that we can take a manual or, you know, some kind of a chart and go A, B, C, and D. It what it is do, and there's so much out there about it. Like the Bhagavad Gita talks about doing your duty, and that's mainly it. You do your duty as it comes to you. You do it without expecting any, you know, anything back from it. No results. So it's a lifetime by lifetime progress we hope will be going into, you know, will be developing. And the fact that people are here and that people have been studying these ideas indicates that something has been opened, because you're open to these ideas. In the back.
We were thinking one of the ways that we routinely focus away from that higher is to identify with the condition. We say, I am upset, I am happy, I am sick. Immediately, we have focused on the terrestrial plane through the personality. The moment we can say, I feel happy, recognizing it as a temporary state we have chosen, we separate ourselves from it, and then once that realization becomes clear, oh, I'm not that thing, and that's what I chose to focus on, what else can that part of me that I am focus on? I can focus on the fact that I am a spiritual being, as are every single one and every bit of life around me. And eventually, it says in that study, in that practice, that kind of development springs up naturally.
Mm-hmm. And to add on to that, only two examples of working through physical conditions is just Mr. Judge and HPB, because both of them were not very healthy. P- people, and HPB especially, she was in pain a lot, yet she was able to work through all that. And there's an instance that we remember reading about. Mr. Judge wasn't feeling very well. He had, we think it was Chagas fever that he'd gotten from South America that flared up periodically. And there was one day he was having a particularly bad day, and one of his students came up to him and said, "Let me help you. Let me do this, and you go and rest." So he said, "Okay, you can do this." And he went on and did something else and didn't take that rest because, you know, these are good examples for us. But it is hard to work through pain and depression, and it is just, we have to keep going, and doing for others always is a help.
So with respect to the one question, tapping into this or that or the difference, well, we do that every day. I mean, we wouldn't be here if we weren't tapping into something more than this physical stuff. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the evolution of soul, I mean, which is kind of broad, kind of vague, kind of a million things in an area, it all blends together. Kind of. But if we just break it down to, you know, expanding our faculties of perception, refining the tools that we have to use, and sure, you know, the first step toward that, the philosophy says, is, you know, live a virtuous life, to do mm-hmm. the things that are there to be done without expecting anything in advance. But in addition to that, I mean, there's a whole lot of, in the literature about meditation and concentration, and mm-hmm. and that's that's a bona fide method, if for lack of a better word, that gets people focused. I mean, it's a matter of focusing and concentration of your whole mm-hmm. inner man.
Yes, the whole idea of using meditation and concentration, that is one way that we can tap into our, you know, our inner life. And by learning how to do that, we become more concentrated, you know, we become less distracted on our outer life. So that in and of itself is a good thing. In the back?
Yes, we were just thinking too. Remind ourselves, this physical brain that we have in this lifetime needs to be trained to open up to these ideas because it's new. It's new like everything else in this lifetime. And it's here because of past ways of thinking and deciding and actions in past lives. So we need to work on training our brain to do this opening through this meditation.
Mm. Yes, we do. That the idea that this brain is is new, just like our whole body is. Just like this whole body is, and it karmically, this is what we've been given. So we always have to bring into account what we are dealt with in each life because we have caused it. So it's our duty to function with the limitations of this form. And we talk about, progress as being, you know, from inward outward. So if we want to improve our physical form, we have to start from our inner, from our spiritual life. Yes?
Well, our language is very important because it reflects our thinking. But it seems that when we consider how do I tap into it, there's an underlying feeling of personality. Mm-hmm. I am this being, and I need to connect, make a line with it, which is separate from myself, to connect. And it's that very thinking that is the obstacle that we have to go up. Because in reality, it is not separate from us. It is one self, We are it already, and it's a process of realizing that and watching ourselves and correcting our thought when we think differently.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there in the Key of Theosophy, there's an interesting portion of it called something about using the proper terms. And we can't remember the name of that section. Oh, definite words for definite
things,
right? And that is true, because if we look at that terminology of tapping in, it's almost like we just have to do a couple things and boom, you know, we've got it. But it's not. We have to earn any progress that we make. It's on us, that whole idea of self-induced and self-devised means. So by using the idea of tapping in, it is a very it is the personality, and we have to look at trying to open up our lower mind. Even though there is one mind, there are two aspects. We have to open up and be willing to accept the dictates, the movement that's coming through the higher self. And we're looking at, higher Manas, trying to connect with that, because higher Manas is connected into or one with Buddhi, which is the high spiritual nature. So this is what we're trying to do, is open that up. Yes.
Okay, so I have a hypothetical question. Let's say you meditate, you work at it, and you learn how to channel this higher energy through you, and you go off and you heal somebody with cancer. Okay, did you just short circuit their karma by doing so?
This is a question that has a multitude of answers to it, because we're looking at, I mean, there is that idea of karma, and we just had a class on this a couple weeks ago with the same question that came up about, you know, if an adept cures somebody, are they interfering with the person's karma? Well, if we have to be careful when we're saying somebody's able to channel the energy, because in many regards, that person may not be controlling what it is that they're doing. And that can actually do more harm to the person. And if they could be interfering with the karma of that person that they cured, if they're not doing it for the right reasons, if they've not learned how to control it. And the adepts won't, I mean, they know when to interfere and when not to interfere. And the question being, if somebody learns how to do this, you know, the question is, where along that path is that person? Are they an adept? What is their motive? There's just too many pieces of the puzzle that we don't know, and we can't really answer that fully if somebody else wants to add to it. In the back?
We were thinking universal law was discussed in a recent class, and karma is that. It is the law of cause and effect. So on the side of, are we interfering with another's karma, we can't. We can work in the cycle. Perhaps we're an agent for change for them, or an agent for causation of something coming forward on that side. But on the side of the one receiving, it is either part of their karmic effect to receive help in whatever form it is. A new CAT scan comes out and they're able to use it and diagnose it and cure it. Or whatever the case might be, they find a holistic remedy. That also is part of the cycle. But we could never, ever, ever judge for another what is going on in their lifetime, in their conditions, in their ability to help themselves or another. We can never We can't judge the karma of another,
mm-hmm.
but we can always seek, as Hippocrates said, to do no harm, seek to do good, and leave the results to the law. The results of that soul struggling with that disease may have been tremendous for the family and friends around them, and that opportunity might have been robbed. We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
With our best intentions, we don't know. So we should just seek to do the best we can and leave the results
right.
to the law.
Thank you. Yes?
If we go back to the idea of there being one source or one cause or one law, karma being the manifestation of that one source, we can no more interfere with law
mm-hmm.
than we can with life, a rising flood of the ocean. It just is overwhelming. But we can work with it or choose not to work with it, and thereby being conscious agents of that law or not. And we think when you're speaking of an adept or one who has that, they know
mm-hmm.
what that law is, and as they said, they cannot supervene it, they can only work with its minor currents.
Yes, thank you. Yes, you've had your hand up.
Yes, the September pamphlet is out, and the very first thing is a discussion of enthusiasm. And it says it is the genius of sincerity, and truth accomplishes no victories without it. And it's our understanding that we, in these rooms, anyone is invited to ask questions, to challenge what they hear. And then it provides the means by which one can develop a vocabulary, deeper understanding, and it's amazing, and to use that correct word, amazing, what I, quote, can see and understand when it is explained in a language in such a way that with my enthusiasm sort of rewards us bit by bit. And if we ask questions, we study, and we actually have a desire to serve others,
mm-hmm.
Perhaps we may get an idea of what is given up. But it mentions humility. What is humility in this case?
Okay, the question is, what is humility? And we would like to comment on the idea of enthusiasm, because we think enthusiasm, it's a very interesting experience, because when somebody is enthusiastic about something, the energy that is provided to them by being enthusiastic can just keep somebody moving. Well, let's take theosophy. If somebody's enthusiastic about it, we may tend to study more, read more, be more apt to maybe have one or two times during the day for quiet meditation. But it's just we think enthusiasm is a type of energy that keeps people pumped up, for lack of another word. But the idea of humility is, we know people who are humble, that no matter how wonderful they are and you compliment them, they'll say, no, don't, you know, it's not me, it's so-and-so who taught me. It's a way of not becoming personal. It's a higher attitude towards oneself, we think, that if somebody is conceited, that's a very lower mind, personal aspect. But if somebody's humble, and truly humble, not just acting it, we think, unless somebody wants to add, we think humility, true humility, is probably a more spiritual aspect about looking at somebody's abilities. Yes?
We think the Aspete says just that. We remember hearing a phrase like, seek to step out of the sunlight into the shadow to give another the chance to shine. We often, in our enthusiasm, want to brighten the day. Well, perhaps at that moment it's best to be quiet and allow another that opportunity. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we don't see it because of our enthusiasm, so it invites us to be perceptive about what's going on.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes?
A follow-up on enthusiasm. It mentions in that article that enthusiasm is an old word that means the influence or the influx of the deific principle. And we were thinking about that, and it occurred to us that when we're really enthusiastic about something, we might even say that, I really feel alive. I've never felt so much alive when I was doing that or considered that. Mm-hmm. And we think that's just an internal way of realizing that life, it really comes from within, that we experience within as an influx of that spiritual energy.
And also when somebody's enthusiastic, they're more one-pointed and can concentrate in one direction better as well. So we think that goes along with that idea of enthusiasm maybe being a more spiritual feeling, we guess. We still have time for a few more questions. Yes.
Yeah, going along with the definition, we were thinking enthusiasm is sort of akin to inspiration, and inspiration is the indwelling, incoming recognition of spirit. So there really is something magical to those words, those ideas.
Yes.
I think it also helps us realize that to understand and practically why these ideas does not mean we withdraw from the world, that we have no feeling, that we become withered up or separate. It means that we feel more alive and more involved and more caring and compassionate than we were before.
Yes.
Because of that connection.
Yes, and we know of so many people who are enthusiastic about a chosen field or a chosen voluntary pursuit, and you sit back and wonder, my goodness, where are they getting all of this energy to do all of this? And we remember telling a friend who was really involved with something, I said, when do you have time to go to work? And they make time. They do. There's just something when they're that focused on, and then we're looking at motive, and because motive rules all, and that they're just able to function with this motive that they have, and the energy, and it's just amazing what some people are able to do. Yes?
If you go into a task with this level of enthusiasm, and then as time goes on, your level of enthusiasm decreases, does that mean it's a signal to move on to a different task? Or are you not connected to that intuition that you had in the first place?
Oh, that we think that that's a question that, you know, you have to look at your motive behind everything. And are you looking at why that enthusiasm waned? Is it more difficult than what somebody anticipated? And is it a personal desire? You know, is it a more spiritual desire? So there's a lot of ways to look at that. And we think once again, is it your duty? And what is your motive behind it? And there's just a lot of different things that would go into that. Yes.
Well, the enthusiasm reminds us of a prophetic phrase from the teachings where the teacher says, my word goes before thee. mighty is the mind. So when our enthusiasm reduces, mind goes up and expands. The enthusiasm has taken a direct course. And once we begin to study these, the rest of the phrase is, mighty is the mind. And after studying these ideas, then we feel as though that we understand. What we have then is faith in ourselves and our own ability to understand. And at further stage, we rest in that faith. So would you say that those that again and again come to study are resting in that fair faith that we have to do the work?
Yes, definitely. We have to do the work. Right. And somebody over here had their hand up.
If one commits, we're talking about karma law, karmic law. So my question is, with regard to that, if somebody commits a crime here, and they either hurt somebody or they go to jail, has their soul committed a crime as well?
Well, it is said that the question having to do with if there's a crime, has the soul committed the crime as well? Well, there's one soul, but there's different aspects to it. And it is said that Atma Buddhi is not affected. The spirit is not affected by whatever crime, so to speak, is going on. And if a crime occurs, it's normally like lower mind connected with the animal soul, the lower mind with the passions and desires. So that can be affected. But when we're looking at higher mind along with Buddhi, with, you know, being the vehicles for Atma, that's not involved at all. They can't be affected, but it's normally the lower mind and the passions and desires that will be taking the brunt of, you know, whatever karmic law has to try and, you know, straighten that out, balance it out, so to speak.
So then when people talk about good karma, bad karma, that sorts of things, you know, most of that seems like it wouldn't really apply, because the majority of bad and good things that are happening to us are functions of our law, you know, our relationship with each other that we make up on a daily basis because we really don't know what else to do. But it seems to be disconnected. Karma would be disconnected from that. Like, why would karma,
karma is not good or bad. I mean, what it is this natural law that is trying to balance out the universe between good and bad, or good and evil, so to speak. So that's what the whole reason is. And good karma, bad karma, it's yours. And it may seem bad for somebody, and it could be good for you. You never. It is such a huge law that affects everything. So good or bad, it's ours, and it's our duty to work with what comes with us, with that enthusiasm. Mr. Judge always said, you know, it's an opportunity. So you had.
The personality may commit the crime and suffer, but the personality is temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the ego who has to come back and face the results of that erring personality.
Mm-hmm.
That idea is the true philosophical foundation of vicarious atonement. That,
wow.
In other words, it's not someone else who suffers for our sins. It's our own higher nature that incarnates from life to life that has to meet the karmic results of the erring personality.
Well, thank you. And on that note, our meeting is adjourned.